the most prominent lecturer at the University of Pittsburgh, not in Professor Woodard's field, but in the field of rhetoric and communication. He has students, classes a la Norman Gravener of 600-700 students. We'll be lecturing on the evolution and development of the protest movement in the 1960s in the Dome Room on Monday. Theodore Wendt, some of the material he's written. Some of you might like to know that in the series which we've been carrying on now for a year and a half, why several of the volumes are out. Book Constitutionalism, The Founding and the Future is out. The book on constitutionalism, The Administrative State, is forthcoming. The series in which Professor Woodard is making his presentation is now, with his presentation, complete, we think. Although we worry about John Locke, we haven't covered John Locke. And the first of the comparative volumes is out, Constitutionalism, the Impact of the U.S. Constitution in Asia. I thought you might like to see that. Some 20 years ago, I guess, a group of people in New York were concerned about the rush to build a new science of human behavior and the massive commitments that American foundations were making to that development. It was an undertaking, several of you know all about it, Tommy Hunter and others, which seemed to have great promise, and it did involve, in a sense, the efforts in the social sciences to bring to bear on social problems those methods that had been so uniquely, singularly successful in the medical and biological and natural sciences, physical sciences. A little group in New York at the Rockefeller Foundation, including someone with whom Professor Woodard had an association at Sullivan and Cromwell, John Foster Dulles, Robert Lovett, Robert Loeb, the professor of medicine at Columbia Medical School, Henry Allen Moe, the president of the Guggenheim Foundation, Raymond Fosdick, who would have been Secretary General of the League of Nations if the United States had joined the League, a number of others, senior people, said, aren't we abandoning a very precious and basic aspect of our human understanding if we neglect legal and political theory? And so my first assignment at the Rockefeller Foundation was to try to assist in the development of a grant program in legal and political philosophy. And the thrust was to see whether, as someone put it, there are any Roscoe Pounds or any classical thinkers of the type that we remember in jurisprudence that could be discovered out in the academic community, and we had quite a substantial program. When you look at the catalog of the law school, you have to use a microscope sometimes at most institutions to find the topic jurisprudence. Maybe that it's not used. But the purpose of these reminiscences is that Professor Cal Woodard is a practitioner of this art, but in his own terms. He has great interest in legal history. He was received his law degree at Yale. He went on to get his PhD at Cambridge University, practiced law with Sullivan and Cromwell, has published in the legal history and legal theory field, and taught in this area. Taught not only here, but even currently at the William and Mary Law School, and is a major authority on Blackstone and on those other legal minds that represent part of our tradition. Several of us have heard him on subjects in his area before, and we thought that there was a missing chair in everything we had done so far on the political theory of the Constitution, and that missing chair was the great legal thinker Blackstone. So we didn't have to go to England, but we're fortunate that Cal Woodard is here, and we're ever so grateful to him for coming and being with us this morning.
Thank you, Ken. Blackstone, I think, is a very interesting person, a name that I suppose everybody's run across, a name also that is associated with one book, let's say the Commentaries on the Laws of England. And yet, I find a lot of people don't understand or don't really quite, shall we say, appreciate the nature of this fellow and the nature of his contribution. And so let me try to talk a little bit about him and the context in which he talked, some of the legacy that I think he gave to this country, quite I don't want to say unwillingly, but without thought, so to speak. He's a mid-18th century person who, a little middle class person who somehow worked his way through sheer brilliance into the great public school system of England, and from there gets to Oxford. He gets to Oxford and becomes an absolutely brilliant classical scholar. As a classical scholar, he falls in love with Oxford. He falls in love with the university life. He was at Pembroke College along with Dr. Johnson and others. Johnson said, you know, we were a nest of singing birds. And amongst those singing birds was Sir William Blackstone, who simply loving the language and learning and the type of life that he found himself thrown into. He wanted to become an Oxford Don, but the politics and the circumstances were such he was not able to do so. So he had to look for a profession. And he was forced, as many middle class people at that time were, to turn to law. He turned to it with great reluctance. He wrote one of the worst poems ever written, presumably. I read it. I don't say how bad it is. It qualifies as being bad, that is, in my view. But it's called A Lawyer's Farewell to His Muse. And what it is about is, oh, my Lord, I've got to leave Oxford, and I've got to go down to that dirty, stinking, swelling city of London and learn how to become a lawyer. So he went down to London and became a lawyer. He practiced for 5 years, but no clients came. And so at this point, he's really worried, seriously worried about what he's going to do with his life. And he's great. He had the great good sense to make the friendship of one of the really great lawyers of the 18th century, one of the great lawyers of all time, Lord Mansfield. So he goes to Mansfield and says, what can I do with my life, for God's sake? I'm a classical scholar, really. But I can't I can't make a living as a classicist. He said, well, look, I have an idea. There's in Oxford, there's a chair for Roman law. They don't teach English common law, but they teach Roman law. Why don't you stand for the chair of Roman law? And then you can get back to Oxford and you can do your classics. Great, he said. So he stood for it. Of course, in those days, pure politics. The chair was in the... in the patronage of the Duke of Newcastle. So when he went to see the Duke of Newcastle for the interview, the Duke said, of course, when we ask you to vote in a certain way, you'll do it. And the famous answer is that Blackstone, rather than say, yes, sir, he said he rolled his eyes and didn't say anything, and thereby he lost the chair. Out of job already. So here we find another, and he goes back to Mansfield, now what shall I do? And Mansfield, of course, is that famous Scot. He'd been trained in, was born in Scotland, came only to England when he was 14 or so, but became, I say, the greatest lawyer. So Mansfield said, look, why don't you do this? Why don't you give some lectures on the English common law in Oxford? Now, this, I think, is a point worth remembering. This is roughly 1750 we're talking about, 1740s. There had never been any lectures. Well, that's not quite true. There have been ad hoc lectures here and there. But there had never been any formal course in English law at Oxford or Cambridge down to 1750. There had been, I'd say, a few ad hoc kind of things. There had been lectures in Roman law, and there had been lectures in canon law, but there had been no lectures whatever in the English common law. And this, of course, is a great constitutional problem which we don't have time to go into. But the English common law was the total property of the Inns of Court in London. And it goes right back all the way to the time where the universities were under the Pope, under the Church, and the English law was around the Crown. They even speak the language, law French, as opposed to Latin. So we get, in English society, we get the development of two great institutions. One, an institution of higher learning. The other, an institution of law. And the lawyers absolutely hate the higher learning. And to this very day, there's an enormous amount of animosity, suspicion, doubt between lawyers and philosophers. Anybody who wants to talk about my subject, law, in some kind of elongated or elevated terms, that's not what lawyers are about. It might be what poetry is about, what philosophy is about. It's not what law is about. The lawyers had this complete monopoly over what goes on. And I say monopoly, I'm really talking quite specifically, because by the 15th century anyway, the Inns of Court, the four major Inns of Court, you will know them, Lincoln's Inn, Inner Temple, Gray's Inn, nobody can be called to the bar who's not a member of the Inns of Court, and nobody can be called to the bench who's not been called to the bar. So there's a complete monopoly there. The lawyers, at least as with respect to the king's law, insofar as the king's law is practiced in the king's courts, and that is normally what traditionally was called English law, certainly the common law, even the common law courts. There was absolutely no the only way you could get any knowledge of the law would be a member of the Inns of Court. Outsiders, Oxbridge, outsiders, they know nothing about it, don't really care a lot about it. The lawyers have a very real sense, a real need of building fences, keeping the public out. And so the law, it's not quite right to say the lawyers own the law, but they certainly had a very strong fiduciary relationship with it. And that relationship meant that they used it in the way that was, they developed it in its own way. And it had its own, as you well know, mysteries that nobody outside the charm circle knew anything about. But within the arm circle, the charm circle, there's the most extraordinary thing about it. You remember, everybody in this room knows when we talk about law, we normally talk about the law, or the word, and the beginning of the word, and the word is either God or law, as the case may be. But we assume that law begins with a word. This is certainly not the case in England. It started without a word. And that's what the common law mystery was. Nobody could ever find what it was. There was always a search for it. Where is it? The beauty, the glory, the people inside the Inns of Court know, but they're not talking. And it's not written. So it really is an oral tradition that was perpetuated by, orally, I think quite literally orally, from generation to generation by the members of the Inns of Court. People on the outside could comment and criticize it. What the judges did, how the system operated, and how it remained on track without the written word has puzzled everybody, including all the continental lawyers, who start, of course, with a word, a Roman civil code, the code of either of Justinian or some other established Napoleon or some other code. So how you could have had a legal system without an established word was the big problem. This was a problem right on down to the 18th century. By the time we get to the 18th century, the system, with its own built-in, as it were, its own built-in momentum, traditions, custom, which really what it was, an oral tradition carried forward under these very limited circumstances. I have to remind you, when we talk about the English law down to the 18th century, on the whole, we're talking about the law that was declared by a judiciary, that's to say the judges of the royal courts, and there were, down to the 18th century, there were very rarely more than 15 at sometime 18. But on the whole, the English law tradition comes from 18, shall we say, 18 judges, and about, shall we say, 150 to 200 lawyers. And they all live together, they all work together, they go on circuit together. It's all one great communal society. Not very great, a very extraordinarily small communal society. But when we talk about the common law, we're talking about King's Bench, we're talking about Commons Pleas, we're talking about Exchequer, and outside, in a very odd way, which we'll talk about in another context, maybe the Chancery. These were the four so-called royal courts. And to be a member, to be able to argue in those courts, you had to be, as I say, the ends of court. You had, they were the people who determined what went on in the courts. And the solicitors on the outside, the attorneys on the outside, various other kinds of lawyers out there are not members of the ends of court and are not lawyers for the purpose. We're talking about barristers, actually, barristers who've been called to the bar and who have a right to practice. They, working with the judges, were the people who made the great context, or rather the great body of law that's called the English common law, which has become the essence of the common law system. In any event, back to Blackstone. We find, in the middle of the 18th century, when he goes to Mansfield, Mansfield said, well, why don't you give some lectures? You're a member of the ends of court. You've been called to the bar. You know the ins and outs of the chicanery of the stuff. Why don't you write a book on it? Why don't you give some lectures here in Oxford on this subject that nobody has ever talked about? Now, there's one thing I should have said. The curious thing, the way it developed, since it was totally practitioner-oriented, it was oriented around the courts, not around the library. It was worried about clients and the particular client cases. It was worried about writs rather than justice. The law had developed in the most extraordinary, arcane way. It was all technical. They therefore worried about what a right is. They worried about whether the writ of assumption will lie or not. And whether the writ of assumption will lie is a technical question depending on whether or not certain relationships exist. So all of law in that sense, you see, was not a theoretical notion. It had nothing to do with justice. The famous old phrase, justice stinks in the nostrils of the common lawyers. Simply not interested in it. What they were worried about was how we can, within the circumscribed notions of a writ, get a cause of action. If we got a cause of action, we can even get a result. But it was, you see, it was so limited. So it was a kind of a technical definition of a subject that had almost no interest if you were not a participant in it. And that was a part of the problem. But I say, Blackstone, when he talks to our friend Mansfield, said, well, maybe I should try to do that. Maybe that's the only thing left for me, so I'll try to do it. And I have to remind you, he said, I'm going to give the lectures. I'm not going to talk to the real lawyers down in London. They are practitioner mind, they got their own problems and so forth. But it was a well-known fact, and this is one of the great mysteries, I think, of the history of the common law. From the late 14th century down to the middle of the 17th century, or beginning of the 17th century, if you as a person became a lawyer, you went to one of the ends of court, you got a pretty fair education in what it was about. That's to say, they had a kind of pupilizing system the elder lawyers, and you had to eat so many meals in. It was a very communal kind of way. But starting sometime in the 17th century, they simply stopped teaching. What they used to say, the empire exploded, business got too big, the older men just simply didn't have time to worry with the younger. And so the legal education went into an extraordinary, even in the English sense, it was not being taught in England, and the ends of court stopped teaching. So when Blackstone talks to Mansfield, they say, look, there's a real need for legal education somewhere. They're not getting it in London. We haven't been given it here. So there was a valid gap, so to speak, to step into. So Blackstone said, okay, I'll do it. And so he undertook to give a course of lectures. Now, I say that's the context in which he writes. He wants to give the things. Now, who's he going to lecture to? Not going to lecture to lawyers, because they're all down, I say, in London. Who he's going to lecture to, and this has a kind of political thing, All the rich kids in this country come to Oxford. That's to say, the kids who are the scions of the great landed estate, the families with landed estates, they'll all be here. And what in the system that exists in the 18th century, they were all going home. These kids are going to go home and become justices of the peace. And they're going to run the country in a local way, not through professional lawyers, but they're going to maintain as local magistrates or through the local squirearchy, they're going to have positions of responsibility. So Blackstone says, I can logically say I'm going to talk to this group. I'm going to give them. The polity of England will be strengthened if that class of people knows something about the law of England. So I'm going to give it to them. And so you have to remember, the book that he wrote, the book that I will say became virtually the code of American law in one sense. We'll talk about that in a minute. But the book was written for 18-year-old non-lawyers, kids who were in Oxford, not to study law, but they've come, they're simply there. And he said, well, I'll see if I can't attract them by talking on a subject that they will when they go home. They're not going to become professionals, but it'd be a part of that general education. But I say that's the context and that's the target to which he was aimed. Now, the big problem, of course, is how do you write the book? People have never written it because nobody. What you had were all the law, insofar as there were any, were found in judges' decisions, and the judges' decisions were reported in the most haphazard manner conceivable. Some, they were all named reporters, of course, in those times, and the old story used to be any barrister who can find a publisher, or any publisher who can find a barrister, can become a reporter. I go to court, and I'll sit there with it on the king's bench. And if I go out to lunch, I miss three cases. Well, too bad. The other story used to be what the judges. One reporter was famous for having heard the half the cases and reported on the other half. That's an ad hoc system, but it didn't make any difference because you see, it was bound together by this small group of people. They all knew who were the good judges, who were the dumbbells, who were the famous cases, and they followed in a kind of a logical kind of manner. The idea of any kind of stare decisis was totally out of the question. They simply didn't have the capacity to do it, and the reporting was totally, very subjective and very. The books were not available, generally speaking, anyway. But under these circumstances, it was incredibly difficult to write a text of what the body of English law was. So, at this point, Blackstone remembers that he's a Roman lawyer. The glory of the Roman law, of course, was that the Roman law, unlike the English, was very mathematically inclined, very logical. And so what he does, the brilliance of the man, was he goes straight all the way back before Justinian to Gaius. Gaius, in the 2nd, 3rd century, had written a famous institute for Roman law students in which he had organized, he provided the one thing English law had never had, a clear organization of what that whole body of statutes, cases, undecided, unreported, forgotten, all the rest of it, well, all that, and what Gaius had done and the Roman lawyers had always done was provide a very clear notion of what the body of law is. And this is what Blackstone provided. Gaius said, the body of Roman law, Blackstone speaking for Gaius, the body of Roman law, the body of English law can be divided into four quadrants. One are those cases, what he called rights of individuals, what we would call civil liberties, and that's what the Constitution essentially deals with, rights to things, which he called property, which we call property, rather. You remember Fred Allen said in the 1930s, they discovered land on his property in Florida. Well, that makes you think what property is. But anyway, And that's pretty much of a common law view, because the law of property was the law of land. And a lot of people say we came to this country, of course, where you have unlimited land, the whole property becomes unleased. And all of a sudden, property becomes contract, but that's another matter. Contract, a way of acquiring property rather than a way of protecting property. Anyway, back to Gaius. We've got four, we've got the cardinals. Volume 1, rights to individuals. Volume 2, rights to things. Volume 3, wrongs against individuals, what we call tort, delict, or voluntary or involuntary wrongs that are not criminal, civil wrongs, and then wrongs against the state, that's a state crime. And there it is, the whole box. In four volumes, this is volume one, and that's the way you put it. You should say in America, two in each saddlebag, and an American judge had the English law right under his hip, so he could ride anywhere. But anyway, so we have volume one, volume two, and broken up with the most marvelous clarity. He did write, Bentham, who spent his whole lifetime hating Blackstone, he quite literally spent his lifetime fumigating against Blackstone, and James John Off exactly the same way. They also taught law. They taught law the manner, taught it good manners and how to speak good English. But Blackstone said, Bentham said, too bad it wasn't put in verse. Why not? Because then it would be poetry. As it is now, it's nothing. But in any event, the four volumes with wonderful clarity. You have clarity. Once we can talk about property, well, there are different kinds of property, aren't there? There are property that are landed, and there are property that are not landed. There are property that can be inherited, and property that can't be inherited. So what he did was break it down, with this wonderful clarity, and put it in a style that was absolutely exquisite. So that becomes the body of it's Roman law. It's Roman categorizations. Which all the common lawyers always say they hated Roman law. For generations, they've always said we had nothing to do with it, and so forth. But the truth is, Blackstone organized it on, indeed, Blackstone had earlier. But in any event, the Roman law foundation was clearly there, and the book couldn't have been written without it. That's the body of the book. But if we look to the book, volume one particularly, you'll find in the first of it, he gives what he calls a discourse on the study of law. And he explains in that article, which was really an article but was published as part of his introduction, again, what I just got through, he doesn't say what I said, let's say why he was publishing it. In the sense of hating London, but he put in there why there was a need for the study of law in a university. And I have to go back there. It really makes me almost blanch when I think about it. That 500 years of stuff wasn't taught in the university, and of course that's in English terms, and I think in Anglo-American terms. His great contribution was he brought the study of English law to universities, and we'll talk about how in this country George Wythe down at William & Mary, or even the chair here, but the royal chair at Harvard, exactly that were all modeled on Blackstone, his great success. So the first chapter in the book is called A Discourse on the Study of Law. But this is what made Bentham so angry. He then puts in the front of the book, after that, what he calls Introduction to the Study of Law. And his reasoning seems to have been like this. Well, if I'm going to give these talks to people who are total strangers to the law, let's say these 18-year-old kids, I ought to give them some kind of a general introduction. And I say English law, the lawyers has eschewed, stayed away from any kind of talk of that kind. So he couldn't find any help in England. So he goes to the continent. And he runs across as a fairly, I think it's almost right to say, I hope I'm not overstating, but kind of a second-rate volume. A second-rate, I mean, in the sense that it was a popular version of natural law. That Pufendorf and Grotius and others in that era had on the continent had developed a kind of natural law, and so Blackstone said, well, I'll borrow from this Swiss named Bullamaki, was a chap who'd written this one book, which was a condensation, really a proofing dog. And so he said, well, I'll lift from Bullamaki's notion, just for this one chapter of Law in General, it's called, and I will explain to the kids some kind of an introduction to the study. And so he puts in there, and of course a lot of people never got beyond the first chapter, again what made Bentham so angry, because the book got so popular. But anyway, what he puts in there a summation of continental natural law theory. And then he goes on four volumes of Roman law, organized common law, which is totally different, had nothing to do with the and somebody might say the whole four volume stuff was a denial of the natural law theory. I mean, it was based on custom, not on God's law at all. It was custom of England, that's what it was. It was based on the ancient law of the Anglo-Saxons, or the Celts, or the Picts, or whatever. But it was not a kind of natural law, the kind that was on the continent. So we get a major confusion at the outset. But here it sits in the beginning. And he delivers himself of a statement that every legal philosopher of the 20th century had really had to wrestle with a great deal, simply called Bentham, I think. He answers the question, what is law? Very simple. Law, whatever it is, commands that which is right and prohibits that which is wrong. Well, that's what the lawyer, what the philosopher is, conflating legality and morality in the most extraordinary way. But he had no trouble with it at all, you see, because he says, law is right, and the judges make, that's his definition. So we start with law, right? And then he puts in the famous pyramid of the natural law idea. At the top is the laws of God, the laws of nature, the laws of nations, and municipal laws. Well, this will come back, but this is where I think our notion of unconstitutionality comes from, actually. But anyway, the whole theory of this, this theory that worked out was that the laws of the higher laws were a hierarchy, and so the laws at the bottom had to be compatible with the laws at the top to be valid. If the state of Virginia passed a statute that ran counter to the laws of God, according to Blackstone and according to this theory, it was not bad law. It was not law at all. But now, of course, there were two kinds of laws. There were those laws which were basic, which dealt with the higher law, and those which dealt with stoplights and that kind of thing, and were therefore of local significance only. But within the realm of serious laws, the Mala and Say kind of things, you had to any law that was counter of Isaiah. Now this pyramid, which he's talking about of law in general, tells us that the English law is the municipal law at the bottom of the pyramid, and that's what we are really wanting to talk about. His discussion when he slips over from there into the next chapter, and I just sort of slipped through it, because the natural law pyramid had always raised a big problem. Who's going to say that the law at the bottom was incompatible with the law at the top? I always remember back in 1969 or 70, when the kids were up in arms, as you remember, a young man came to my office and said, I'm a weatherman, and I'd like to write a paper on natural law. And I said, why? He said, because I think the laws of the United States run counter to the laws of God, or the laws of nature, I forgot what he said. And I said, it'd be interesting, well, how about writing a paper, man, and see what you have to say. And he didn't say anything at all. But it's very interesting this notion of law not being law, if it runs counter to, raises two sides to it. One is a very conservative side, that law can never be changed. The other is that it can be changed by anybody, or it can be denied by anybody. all of us having a right to say what the law of God is or God. I mean, that's the kind of problem that was sort of inherent in that. But Blackstone solved that problem in a way that I think had some influence in this country. He said there's only one group of people in Britain who had the power to say what the higher law is, and that is the judges. They are the people who have the authority to say whether a given law is or is not compatible with the higher law. And if it is compatible, then of course it is law. If it isn't compatible, as he says, it's not law at all. It's not bad law. It's not law at all. That's the notion of unconstitutionality that I mentioned. And I think that's really where our notion of a Supreme Court. Even though in England, no judge ever dared, right down to this present time, never dared say a statute of Parliament, certainly in the 18th century, right after the William and Mary thing, would not have said, would have dared to do so. But Blackstone recognizes, in the context of the common law anyway, that the judges are the only people who have the authority and the power to say what the law is. Now, when we think about the judge or the judiciary in the context that I've been talking about, I think we can see that Blackstone's treatment of the judges and putting this natural law idea in there was very important on this side of the water. Now, let me just go forward with a couple of other things, though. He next puts in a kind of an introductory chapter. He's given an discourse on legal education. Then he's given a thing of law in general. And then he gives a chapter on the English law in general, and then he goes into the four chapters. But it's in that third chapter, which is called, I've forgotten what it, I think it's called, Of the English Law, something like that. Now that's where he talks about the judges, and that's where he talks about the about judges having the responsibility of making the determinations. But he also makes what I think was a classic blunder, a blunder that, in context of what I've already said, should be fairly clear. That's to say, Blackstone said that when a judge, when a judge not only has the responsibility of deciding cases, but he is bound by precedent to any earlier decision, except in the case of manifest error. In which case it wouldn't be bad law, it would be the case I was just talking about. But he renders, in a very, I think, in a certain sense, extraordinary and unfortunate way, he renders the common law tradition, which was precedent, recognizing earlier decisions that were good decisions, and recognizing earlier decisions that were well received and had been followed, but the idea of being bound by every decision, whatever it was, whoever handed it down, was totally unthinkable, as I say, given the context of the times anyway. But he didn't render it that way. You see, he says a judge is bound by every earlier decision, whether it was stupid or not, or so long as it wasn't manifest error, it had to be followed. That's a shift. Well, he made a shift in legal terms from a doctrine of precedent to a doctrine of stare decisis, which locks a judiciary in a most extraordinary way, in a way it was impossible for. But in any event, he made that transition. Everybody would say in terms of it was a misstatement of what the law of England was at the time, but it came to this country. People read it, and it became a dominant factor, I think, in this country, but leaving that aside. Now, his relation with the judiciary with respect to both the importance of the judges in determining what the unwritten law is, in determining the unwritten law, but also in determining in some kind of a non-common law, natural law hierarchy, gave the judges or the judiciary a very heightened role. I think John Marshall recognized that or stepped into or built on that when he decided Marbury against Madison. The idea of judicial independence was very strong in Blackstone's writing, but the idea of judicial uh, uh, superiority was not there, unless we say it came into the natural orders, and I was just describing. In any event, so Blackstone talked about very much about the judiciary and its independence and its role in a natural law world, which was not English, I don't think, at all. But it was accepted as such. Now, when the book was published, that I say the lectures, which went into great, in wonderful, not detail, but wonderful generalizations of what the whole body of law was, going into every aspect of it, it became a minor sensation because. First, it did give light where there had been darkness before. People could come and they could understand because he had talked in such wonderful content. The legal historian would tell you, this is Sir Henry Maine talking, for example, specifically, that it was impossible, it would have been impossible for that book to have been written earlier, given the way the law had evolved. That's to say, it had all been procedure and practice. It took almost 500 years of custom to have been built up. And they always would say, Maine, for example, would say the English law didn't start with the rules, it starts with the practice. And as the practice developed through time, it was became possible to separate the practice from the rules, so it was possible to say that there have been 40 cases that have dealt with the idea of what happens when my wagon bumps into yours. And some kind of notion of tort liability could be deduced from the decisions. But nobody started with those decisions. And I say what Blackstone really did do was to give, almost in what we now call restatement form, or what other people call a kind of a code form of what the common law was. It frightened a lot of people. I have in my office a lecture that was given to the University of Pennsylvania in 1878, I think, by Justice Bradley of the U.S. Supreme Court. And he was telling the members of the graduating class how they ought to become good lawyers. A Supreme Court justice talking to young lawyers. And he says, I think what you ought to do is follow the model of my friend Mr. George Wood of the New York Bar, who I've never heard of, but George Wood was a great friend of Daddy's. And what George Wood would do, apparently, was every day at lunch, he would take the chapter of Blackstone with him to lunch, and he would read it, and he would reread it, and he would read it yet again, and then he would commit it to memory. Bradley said, ultimately, my friend George Wood was a walking commentary unto himself. Well, that scared the daylights out of everybody who knew anything about Blackstone, because Blackstone's definitions were crude and not very sophisticated. His ideas for property, for example, really did set back his notion of his definition of property. Prohibits absolute dominion over, which was a description which prohibited any kind of growth in a world where fences were the total law. The ad coelum theory of law to the, and so forth. One would want to debate, but he doesn't give them in debatable form. He says that this is the law, and this is what God has ordained, this is what the judges have ordained. So he created a lot of things that were wonderfully clear, but overly simplistic, and that's what I say made both Bentham and Austin and Jefferson wouldn't even let it be taught in this university. He said it was honey and Mansfieldism, and all it did was make law so simple that nobody could that people thought they understood it, but they didn't understand anything about it at all. Of course, that was part natural law, as part of common lawyer's reaction to trying to popularize such a subject. But in any event, the Blackstone book came to this country at about the time when our Constitution was being framed, and I think it's fair to say, when I look back at the book, I usually think of it as really the first draft of a restatement of the English law stopped the clock, circa 1750, and it's absolutely marvelous for that purpose. It gives you a wonderful idea of what the scope of the law was, and there are plenty of images. People like, lots of people, take for example, Sir William Jones, he read part of it. My God, the whole nation, the notion of bailments, which is one of the most intricate and the most complicated, when I lend you my hat and you do things with it. And the variations of lending and all that, bailments of all kinds. He said, Blackstone disposed of it in three sentences. Now, how are you thinking about it? So Jones goes back, he said, right, Jones on bailments, which is one of the famous law books, was written just because of the paucity of Blackstone's treatment. And indeed, he inspired a whole generation of law, legal professors who found gaps, huge gaps, of glossed over sentences in the book. So in that sense, he inspired a legal learning of a kind that hadn't been before, and was itself a great champion. But they say, as I said before, common law is custom, and custom, if it changes very slowly, not by any single person's idea, but it grows rather than Edmund Burke was a great champion, said England doesn't need, we don't need a constitution because we've got history. We don't need a constitution like the French do because Charles I lost his head. That's what the whole, our history tells us what our relations with the crown are. We don't have to look to a document. A document is totally false. Well, I say the Americans weren't totally happy with that. They wanted some kind of written document. They were French in the French Revolution sense, but when they went to write the Constitution, I always thought it was very interesting because I think the Constitution itself is a terrible mésalliance, if you like, a mixture. The text is a blueprint for government. Then we have the Bill of the Amendments, and it seems to me the Bill of Rights, the First Amendment, is really straight from Blackstone, Blackstone's Rights of Englishmen, and the Rights of Englishmen are, in Jefferson's terms, based in some senses on natural law, or they're based on the custom of England. Not quite clear what they're based on, but in any event, it's totally different in conception, I think, from what the text of the thing, that's to say the body of the thing itself, as a blueprint of how the division of government will work and all that, the separation of powers. That's one philosophy of government, which is a kind of, in the age of Goethe, was a period of people who were trying to build and to grow. The fear of what's being built, expressed in the First Amendment, comes straight back to the natural law notions or to the rights of Englishmen notion that Blackstone talked about. I should just remind you, when Blackstone talked about the rights of Englishmen, which was a phrase that was very popular because all the charters, the Charter of the Virginia Company or the East India Company, all these kind of charters, typically they'll say to a company that you, Mr. East India Company, you can govern your corner of the world, you can have your own court system and all that, but Englishmen will be allowed or be guaranteed the rights of Englishmen as kind of a phrase of art. And so it came to have a certain kind of international meaning as the empire spread around the world. The rights of Englishmen that he mainly talked about were the rights of personal security, which were right not to be injured or maimed or anything of that sort. But then he talked about the rights of personal liberty, where in that area is where he talked about habeas corpus and the other unfair restrictions on one's coming and going, restraints against the government. But the third one were the rights of property. I think the framers, though they would have seen in Blackstone, because I should have said this, because the Blackstone book is full of, he was a Tory, and he thinks the Church of England is about the greatest thing on this earth, and next to the king, and the colonists didn't like that part particularly, but he's kind of a, he's a very
middle class person who become Tory, and therefore he's more Tory than the Tories in a certain kind of way, and that gets into the book. And again, that's what made Bentham and the other reformers so angry. They thought he was talking endlessly about the virtues of what wasn't all that virtuous. The rights of Englishmen idea gets, I think, into our constitution under the name of the right. And we have to always think about the notion, I say, of unconstitutionality. I think that is straight from the natural law idea, that it's not bad law. It's not law at all. If it passes, all we did was build our own human kind of hierarchy: federal constitution, federal statutes, state constitution, state statutes, local government, and so forth. And if you fall out of line, it's not bad law, it's not law at all. It's the same kind of hierarchy that we replicated. I've always thought that Joseph Story, who is a striking parallel, he was usually said to be the American Blackstone, only he did it in 10 volumes rather than in 4 volumes. And he did it different kind of, well, different. Anyway, but Story, a chair was formed for Story at Harvard, the Dane chair, to do exactly what Viner founded the chair at for Blackstone. So I say there are striking parallels there. Anyway, excuse me, I talked too long, said too little, and rambled in a lot of different directions, for which I apologize. That's a little bit about who he was and what he was.
Anybody who thought Blackstone couldn't come alive. Who would like to ask the first question, whether you're a lawyer or a non-lawyer?
Could I ask, what is the status? Wasn't there a Bill of Rights passed by Parliament in 1694? And does that help? How does that compare with our Bill of Rights?
Well, that, as you just said, to be one of the real founding stones of parliamentary supremacy. I think our Bill of Rights is, I can answer that question. Our Bill of Rights is much more, more personal. I thought the English Bill of Rights was more in terms of the rights of the crown, or establishing what the role of the crown would be with respect to English law, rather than the individual rights of individuals, the kind that he's talking about, and it establishes the fact that the crown sits up. I also thought there was a major question in England, I think, down to the 17th century, and that is the king had two different functions, or two different, shall we say, modes. The king is a medieval king, and as such he is the fountain of justice. Who has higher obligations, the highest obligation to the whole state, and one of those obligations is to see that law and order is done, and in that context he delegates to the judges the responsibility of making the law. But the king, since he has an obligation to justice, not to law, there's always an appeal back from the king back to from the courts back to the king, and that's the so-called royal prerogative, the prerogative powers that the king had over law, and that's one mode, and in which case there we have the king in a certain sense over the law, at least over the law of the king and the courts. The other mode was when William the Conqueror became king of England, he didn't want to be a conqueror. He wanted to claim his title through his kinship with Edward the Confessor, and therefore he had a legal right to serve as king. I remember when my oldest son, named William, was born, I got a cable from a fellow who said, is he the conqueror or the bastard? My wife didn't think that was particularly funny. But anyway, but the conqueror's idea was that that he was not a conqueror and as such. And so this is where, in a certain sense, the whole trouble comes, I think. The conqueror says, I will take the throne subject to the ancient constitution and laws of England. And nobody had ever known what they were. I mean, they went back to the Danes and back to the Teutonic forest, and they went everywhere. But he said, I will accept subject to. And so here we've got the king sitting on the throne. On one side, he's the fountain of justice. On the other, he's under the ancient constitution, whatever it may be. And whether he's over or under is going to be the ongoing question. And the in the 17th century, the judges, Sir Edward Coke and the parliamentarians will join hands, and they want to say to the king, look, you are abusing your prerogative rights, and we want to go over your head and show that you are abusing the ancient constitution, so we're going to pull you down. With the judges who are in a certain sense the subject of the king, the fountain of justice, but who say they have the sole authority over the ancient constitution, so they want to go back. I'm sorry, I'm afraid it's probably confusing. But anyway, it was this kind of ambiguity that was finally resolved, I think, with Charles I's departure, or James I's departure, maybe. But when William and Mary are brought back, they are put on the throne at the invitation, as it were, of the Parliament. And Parliament does not say how you will sit or what your duties are, but they do. They say, we're going to keep the purse strings. And so the king, the royal crown, so to speak, sits at the invitation. From that time on, there can be no question that the king-in-parliament is the sovereign, and the question of who is over English law has been resolved. It's still unresolved whether or not if a statute were passed by Parliament, that a Nuremberg type statute that really was basically inhumane, whether or not a common law judge would say it's unconstitutional because it goes against the ancient constitution. Whether or not it would be done or not, nobody knows. But that argument would still be there. I don't think I can answer your question still, though.
Which has the more divine status? I got the impression that the U.S. one has.
British divine?
Well, in the sense that it was a major document. But as time went on, it assumed considerably, the British bill assumed considerably more importance.
Well, as I said, I don't think the doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty has been seriously questioned, certainly not by the judiciary, and they're the only ones who could really question it, though the arguably, somebody might say, the Reform Bill of 1832, which changed the electorate, really dramatically, fundamentally changed the governance of England. But our Bill of Rights I don't think I can answer the question. Can anybody help me with it? I'm just not sure. Can you
help me? Certainly can't on that.
I don't think I can answer it. Dr. Johnson said, ignorance, sir. Ignorance. That's the only answer I got.
Wasn't that mostly about rights for the nobles versus the king or the British?
Which was the
British Bill of Rights, wasn't that mostly concerned with the rights of the nobles versus the king?
Oh, yeah, we don't have Magna Carta.
Yeah, but this other one was too, wasn't it more of the same?
No, I don't think so. And with respect to Magna Carta, nobody's ever known what the nature of that document is. People have always said that was a feudal document, as you're suggesting. Had nothing to do with it. He put chapter 31, whatever, 32, whatever it is in there, but essentially a feudal document. And Cook, Lord Cook, in the 17th century, discovers it, dredges it back up in the context of what we were talking about a minute ago when Charles Stewart gets out of line. But that's a debate that's ongoing. But I find it hard to characterize. One thing I think that statute did try to do was try to define that Bill of Rights. I'm just not familiar enough with it to respond to the question, but it does, in a certain sense, redefine the importance of the judiciary. And out of that grew the idea of William. William is the first person, the first king, and he's actually forced to do it, to sign a statute saying that that the judges will serve for good conduct, not in our sense. They will have a life tenure, in effect, rather than being removed at political preference. But it's not until, I think, about 1732 that a statute is passed that says that the king, the judges, up until that time, whenever the king died, all judges resigned as a matter of course. But then it said judges will serve irrespective of the sovereign, of the life of the appointing king. But the Bill of Rights, I don't think I can say more about it. It would be more helpful.
Can I shift gears now? I enjoyed hearing you as I always do, and I remember times when we crossed swords, and one of those concerned my irritation at a meeting where I felt the lawyers were taking over the prerogatives of the doctors. One profession claiming the right to make decisions, life and death decisions, could only be made in court. And most doctors know that a whole lot of life and death decisions are not made in court. Could you said some things about black, about the derivation of this book that made me realize that the laws of court were used to having the judges make all final decisions.
Right. And now, they were the only people who could do it.
That's right. Now, are we suffering, or do we still have that frame of mind that leads us to be the most litigious society in the world? Develop that. I just want to hear you.
Well, let me say a couple of things. The first is that whatever one has to say about the Constitution, what I mentioned a moment ago, there was the text, and then there's the Bill of Rights. But the Constitution says zero, almost zero, about what we call private law and what the whole common law is about. The private law is to say rights of when you get hit by cars or when you, all those things. What went on in the first four volumes, our Constitution said zero. And that's why the book was so important. Now, anybody want to know any contracts or torts or bailments, any of that kind of stuff, Blackstone provided some kind of an answer. So it stepped in a huge gap. Now, and that's all judge-made law, as opposed to statute. But what's happened in the last 100 years is that statutes have come in everywhere. Everybody's always pointed out that the common law is becoming much more like the continent. The continent is becoming much more like the common law, in the sense that the form of our law is not oral, in the sense of judicial decisions, is increasing the statutes. On the continent, though they start with the code, increasingly how the judges interpret the code is becoming important. So that's one point that I stress. What I would call the common law mentality is what you were talking about, is that we still feel in this country that even though we've got statutes, nobody knows what the statute means until a judge has construed it. So in other words, the common law, we common lawized, if you like, is there such a word? Just that. Blackstone used to always draw a picture, at least I think he would. He would draw a picture. The common law tradition was that if we looked at the law, it's just like looking at a plank. You'll see the grains going smoothly, centuries, and then there's a knot hole, and that's a statue. And then they'll say, That's disharmonious kind of change. And I say that's the common law tradition, and that's what we still got. Now, when you and I had our big controversy, you never understood my point, of course. Well, I don't the common law, once in what the common law had, what I thought we were dealing with in a case like that, and where I think the common law is really virtuous, is that what happens when we've got a kid who's got to pull the plug, and the man is going to die if we pull the plug? What's going to happen? If somebody pulls the plug, there's a possibility of being accused of homicide, right?
Right.
Homicide is a legal question, right? And nobody wants to be sued or prosecuted for homicide. Now, my point was, in these very delicate kind of questions, what we really want is a determination of who ought to make the decision. If we get a judge, is the only person who can say, look, in making that decision, the doctor ought to make it. Not the clergyman, and not the head nurse, but the doctor or the head of the family. And since that the function of the court in that sense is to settle matters. Not to settle it correctly necessarily, but to say who is going to settle it correctly. And that's what I think what law has the great capacity of doing, of saying, putting the responsibility where it ought to be put, and at the same time saying if we give you that responsibility, we'll not hold you accountable for murder or for homicide. So giving you authority, delegating you, and it seems to me that's what law has been doing. In all these cases where we see so much litigation, nobody's quite clear what the responsibility is, and therefore, in that sense, the lawyers, here's one way they used to put it, and I'm totally off base now, forgive me, but they used to say, in an Islamic kind of society, where we've got total agreement among the clergy that we have a theocracy, we don't need law. Law, morality, nothing, we've got theology. Arguably in colonial New England in the 17th century, we had something like that. But then as we became more diverse, religiously speaking, boom, we had to drop down to a level of morality. And we could say that though we don't worship in the same way, most of us have some notion of what it means to be, quote, good. We know what is right and what is wrong, and we ought to obligate ourselves and conduct ourselves in some kind of way. There was a widespread agreement as to the moral values of society. Arguably, in the 20th century, what's happened, given a lot of the changes, we've fallen down to a lower level, lower in a hierarchical sense, but where we can't all agree on religion, we can't all agree on morality, but we can all agree on legal liability. And so legal liability becomes the means by which, in a really diverse society, that we hold people together. And we'll say, it might not be good for you to do it, but you will not charge you legally if you do it. And in this sense, it seems to me what we have watched is law has become more important almost as a consequence of loss of the other kind of that. But that's all I was
talking about. Very helpful to me.
I wish you acknowledged that 2 years ago. I wouldn't have this scab here.
Another one of your nemesis.
There's a question back here in the amen corner.
Yeah,
I don't intend it to be a backstabbing question. This is a rather drier question than Dr. Hunter's, perhaps less emotionally charged. Perhaps therefore admissible of a clearer answer.
Here's a man who's come into my classes before and I've never been able to follow that.
Yeah. And that is, I wonder what your reflections would be on the role of a very different cultural, philosophical tradition, not the English common law custom backed up by an established church, etc., etc., but the Enlightenment tradition, where now in place of the eternal law of God, you've got doctrines about universality of human nature, the constitution of human nature, and doctrines of natural rights that are presumed to be compatible, see, with this notion. So within the Constitution of the United States, with its powerful, if not satisfactory, clear distinction between church and state, religious and legal, there is no need to appeal to an eternal law, see, in anything like the classical sense. That has become legally, philosophically irrelevant to the determination of the rights of man.
Yeah. Well, first let me, naturally I can't answer the question, but let me say, again, all this discourse of the Enlightenment kind was irrelevant to English law, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, the English law is still developing in its own court way, totally. Yeah. So this is all outside, extra legal in a fundamental kind of sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only when the law becomes part of universities that it will get brought into it. Blackstone himself, when he talks tries to justify things, he brings in Locke and he brings in Cook and the other people who were not so much Cook, but certainly Locke. And Harrington, I think he cites, and Montesquieu, he cites as part of his general discourse. But it's all gloss. That's all introduction to the law of England. It's not what he would call seriously important. Of course, the interesting thing about our Constitution is that it says in its own terms that the people are sovereign. That we put ourselves distinctly under human law. And that's what's always been, I've always thought, the major conflict between the main body of the Constitution and the implicit notion that there are rights in the First Amendment that don't come from the law made by human beings. That's kind of, I say, that's been a natural law notion been infused in there. Everybody remembers, of course, how it happened. The famous story, Hamilton reads the thing and said, oh my God, it'll not work, not enough power in it. Jefferson reads it and says, for God's sake, who's going to control it? And at that point, he insists, Jefferson, that the First Amendment be added. I think that is really simply a mixture of a tradition. I can't see how those two things work together in any kind of consistent way. Though I will agree with you, I certainly would agree with you that they were all 18th century men who were interested when somebody showed that Newton could plot how a cannonball, the trajectory of a cannonball without leaving his rooms in Trinity College, showing what reason could do. And that I think had an enormous impact on every thinking person in this country as well as in England. But the curious thing was, still, in England, had zero to do with the common law. That is what I think is appallingly true. Though I do have to say this as an aside, Baron Pollock, who was Sir Frederick Pollock's grandfather, was supposed to have made his reputation because he found a mathematical flaw in Newton when he was an undergraduate. And so his reputation was secure forever there. But I don't think, you say something about your question, dude.
I'm quite happy with what you said about it. the net effect of what you say is that there is a, in the Constitution, together with the Bill of Rights, there is a fundamental, at least conceptual, incoherence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But oddly enough, the judge, just as in the common law, just as in Blackstone, is the judiciary becomes the bridge between the two.
Yeah.
And I say the notion of unconstitutionality. Remember, mm-hmm. I say the idea of a written constitution itself was so new. The idea of unconstitutionality, that was a new notion itself. The idea that the judges would be the ones who would do that, and which inevitably led to judicial supremacy, as opposed to judicial independence, which had been the great English contribution, But judicial supremacy, I think, naturally flowed in our context in that way. I think the inconsistency is there. And I think it's probably richer for it. But, yes, sir?
Well, don't we appeal? I think about your pyramid, after law pyramid,
right.
Now coming to be in America with the Supreme Court declaring something unconstitutional in place of what there had been in continental natural law. But isn't there then in American culture strong, even with the diversity, another pyramid in which you can appeal beyond decisions of the court? I mean, what all the people like Lincoln, what people who said, you know, Tawney and the court may say this about Dred Scott, we're appealing beyond that to another pyramid which captures partly enlightenment and partly out of
I think
religious stream. So, and your weatherman, though
that's
kind
right.
of
that's
scary right. in some way, that there's a conceptual moral appeal behind even the determination of judges that something's unconstitutional. That's fairly strong.
I think it's the right and civil. Actually, I would say rather than the Bill of Rights, I'd say that really is the Declaration of Independence tradition. Because you remember in the Declaration of Independence, what they were really saying was that you Englishmen have violated the English law. What we want is the English law to be upheld. The common law, the ancient constitution, whatever it was, you've gone beyond it. And I still think that's a part of, I totally agree with you, and I think, and I know Judy was coming to my class and said that. That this idea of civil disobedience or the right to some appeal higher than the highest authority is still very much a part. And I guess it's enlightenment, is it? Or is it with Aquinas?
Protestant dissent.
Well, I was just thinking Aquinas. I don't know.
Yes, I think it goes behind the enlightenment.
Well, Aquinas says if you appeal, you have to win. I mean, if you rebel.
Yeah. Fernbach, one or two more questions.
I suppose one might ask rhetorically, at least, whether there isn't the sovereign right to be inconsistent. In this connection, but I wanted to push it if you would.
As an Austinian, when you start reading the question of sovereign, I have full sovereignty.
Well, if you would, it would be very interesting to hear you comment on Madame Thatcher's proposals to reform the judicial and court system.
I don't think, just as a question here, I don't think I can help very much. Mainly because I die sometime around 1800, and I'm not sure I'm going to remember. But it's very, let me just say one thing which goes in that direction, but not far. If we stopped the clock in 1800 and looked at the American bar as opposed to the English bar, what we would have seen would be an American bar trying desperately to be like the English bar, and failing in many respects. Not because of legal, anyway, failing. But everybody, generally speaking, we modeled, though we didn't. We tried in several states, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, various other places, tried the idea of barrister solicitor distinctions, but leaving that aside, generally speaking, the idea was that law, the English model was our model. If we stopped the clock in 1920, we find that the bar had gone totally different directions already, and two different directions. The big corporations have come into being, so we now have corporate clients, and with corporate clients, we have corporate retainers, and with corporate retainers, lawyers are no longer, in the old sense, and the sense they had been when they were members of the ends of court, they were brothers to the judges, and the judges had formerly been members. They are now, as on retainers, they are no longer officers of the court. Quite literally, they are employees of and oddly, interestingly enough, the corporate lawyer is paid in that sense, at that time anyway, paid to keep out of court rather than to go into court. So we get the rise, the leadership of the American bar seems to be shifting in a direction of a kind of a solicitor rather than a barrister, an office working kind of person rather than a forensic expert or person who leaves before the jury, which was a common law tradition. The other development that we watch is that judiciary in this country, and I think because of the law schools, here's an aside, Blackstone, though he brought the study of law to Oxford and later went to Cambridge, it didn't work throughout most of the 19th century. And I think really right down to this very day, law is a stepchild in a university, in an English university. When Maitland gave his inaugural lecture in 1900 the Downing Chair at Cambridge, and the title of his lecture was, "Is there a place for law in an English university?" This is 1900. Mm-hmm. And his answer is, "Well, I'm not so sure, but I've got the job, so I'll take it." But it's very, very something different. Well, what has happened, of course, as I say, in this country, as law became more a part of universities, law got wrapped up in many academic kind of disputes. We got the rise of first the case method at Harvard Law School, and then after that, legal realism, and various forms of very serious sociological jurisprudence, different approaches to law, all of which tended to give the judge more responsibility, or which identified more clearly at a time when the law itself was becoming more statutory in form, and the leadership of the bar was being corporate and in office, the judges were being called upon jurisprudentially to be more active in their role as expounders of law or so forth. And so I think American law became much richer in that context, and we watched. So if we stop the clock today and look at an English lawyer compared to an American lawyer, they're both common law lawyers, but there's a huge difference in how they approach things and so forth. Now, that's just a background comment. Now, the consequence of what I want to say is that in the course of the 19th century, one other background comment, in the course of the 19th century, England, of course, went from a very much of a laissez-faire society to a welfare state society. And what that really meant, it went from a society that was based on judge-made common law, essentially to a form of administrative law, a law that was governed, law that was delegated, Parliament would delegate to local magistrates or to local forms of one kind or another, ministries, obligations with respect to whole corners of education or medicine or health or whatever. And the consequence was, it's often been said, that the English judiciary went into an eclipse in the 19th century. At the very time when the American judiciary was rising through the law school, I think, inspired changes that went on, the English judiciary sat still. And the English judiciary became more, I think, increasingly, I'm getting my mores and nesses mixed up here, but I think they became less central. They became more concerned with kind of petty issues and serving as chairman of the royal commissions, but not really making the kind of playing a major role as the American judiciary did. The rise of the American judiciary, which Tom deplores under certain circumstances, has been a change in the whole nature and notion of what law is all about. The role of law in our society, it has taken on a different role here, I think, than from in England. And I think, Lord, I go back to Blackstone in Divine Chair, which is the first chair for teaching. But the tort thing that you were talking about was another kind of a one of the characteristics, one of the most fundamental parts of the common law was, of course, the jury. And the question was, what would be the role of the jury in 20th century litigation? And a lot of people, the legal realists, people like Jerome Frank, hated 12 hod carriers, good and true. But as society became more complex, a lot of people were more. A great deal of, and so the British simply outlawed the jury, the civil jury. But of course, the big problem, you can't compare tort in England with tort in America in the 20th century, because they had national health. If I got hit by a car, I went to the hospital and the national health took care of the broken legs and all that. There would be other sides of it. But in this country, that has to be a part of the litigation. And so the jury, my colleague Jeffrey O'Connell, feels very deeply on these matters, and we all do, about the role of whether there should be a jury or the lottery of what's happened in these kind of tort cases. But one major difference in the country, in the two countries, was that they had a national health which took care of the basic thing of physical injury. Under those circumstances, to take the jury out of it for the other aspects of made some sense, and that's what they've done. But now, as you know, this will be the final thing, I promise. As England now part of the common market, and the European Community, right? That's what's giving rise to that need for a written constitution, some kind of protection against what's going on over there.
They feel it very strongly.
Pardon?
They feel it. Madam Thatcher feels that very strongly.
Yes, she does. But I don't think I answered your question. I talked all about it.
Henry Thielbar and others have said that one of the purposes of the center ought to be to introduce remarkable scholars within the university to one another, among other things, but also to the wider community, particularly after last night. All of us know all about Richard Morgan and people of that kind. Dean Rusk used to say that his main function as president of a foundation was to visit universities and introduce members of the various faculties to one another. They would never have met each other. Fortunately, Tom and Julian have met our speaker and confronted him on previous occasions, and he them. But just a little inside note, we talked about who could have something to say about Blackstone, and somebody said, maybe H.L.A. Hart has said something about Blackstone, and some other impossible names were mentioned, and finally, one of us remembered that we'd heard our speaker comment on this. And the impoverishment of communities, I think, in our society has a great deal to do with our failure to discover the resources we have in our midst. And I think today is, among other things, a dramatic example of how much harder we ought to work to get acquainted with each other. So we thank you very much.